This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or email johnmarciano@macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is part two of chapter one, which contains a discussion of the chapter and the lecture on April 26, 2005. Part one contains Dr. Marciano's opening remarks. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
Okay, so the rest of the time, you know, we've got till at least 9 o'clock. So, get some reflections, thoughts, jump in, comments, whatever.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the, because of that movie that's coming out now, Heaven's Gate or something like that, about the Crusades. I mean, that was that kind of activity that was going on, even as far back as that, of conquering people who didn't fit the norm of the white Christian empire, and they attempted to do that to the Muslim world.
Yeah, I saw the trailer for that film. It looks like in fact, it's Ridley Scott as the director, and it looks like a big blockbuster. Orlando Bloom, Liam Neeson. I'm not giving a movie plug here. I just saw the trailer, but it's about the Crusades, and again, if we think back in terms of our history, what little I learned about the Crusades, and let's face it, most of us, what we learned in history when in one ear out the other quickly in our classes was, there were these infidels and whatever, and these knights, and, horseback with incredible swords and bows and arrows, and they went and conquered these people. And that was my knowledge of the Crusades. Just jump in.
So as you were just saying, I mean, the establishment history is that, the natives were conquered in the name of some idea of progress. And, what you're saying is that there was there's a heavy, Christian crusade element, racist element to what was done to the indigenous peoples here, as well as what was done to Jews, gypsies, and others, by the Nazis. But it seems to me that, from what Zinn's saying here as well, that there was, while religion may be a justification, it wasn't necessarily the motive. And the motive is always and, forever will be some form of commerce or financial motive, and people came here for gold and slaves. And there's it wasn't called capitalism back then, but can we distinguish between a justification that was used, but then a deeper motive, or are we reducing, these horrors that were done to religion and not getting to maybe a deeper financial. I mean, to reduce Nazism to just racism ignores the fact that, fascism and Nazism by definition is extreme capitalism and extreme, co-optation of government by big business with a racist overtone as the justification for the people. I mean, maybe anyone could comment on that, or John, you can.
I ended up, in terms of how the lecture, I'm all wired or whatever here, I don't know, emphasizing some of the ideological aspects, but you're absolutely right in that there was a tangible, Columbus and others came here and had a certain belief structure about the world, everyone does. In the same way the slave traders. I mean, you don't have the continuation of the slave trade, Africa, the triangle trade to the Caribbean and up to the US, etc., and building of thousands of ships and outfitting these ships and paying the men on the ships very, very little, of course, unless there was some profit in that trade. It would have been totally, it wasn't this irrational desire that they just somehow hated black people and they just wanted to go get a bunch of people and own, right? It was a whole social relationship. And in one of the books that'll be on the reading list later, Eric Williams, who actually I believe was the prime minister of Barbados or one of the islands in the Caribbean, has a marvelous work on capitalism and slavery. So the conquerors who came expected to go back, and we know from their own records, their own logs, they were looking for gold, they wanted to take gold, and of course you have the whole ideological overlay of religion, a justification. You need a rationalization to do what clearly they knew were horrible things. Okay, I mean, you have to find some way to justify, because they thought they were doing good, evidently. I mean, evidently, if they felt in their heart of hearts they weren't, I mean, some of them would have stopped. So there is this connection between ideas and material resources. And as one of my students said, you know, somebody's got to get something tangible back out of all of this. And that plunder, by the way, that plunder from the New World, this is the New World, helped build the Industrial Revolution and capitalism in Europe. I mean, you know, it's huge. I mean, we don't know how much. Immense resources. It's still going on, of course. The resources being taken from Asia, Africa, the most, and Latin America, and moved to Japan, North, you know, Europe, and the United States. So this is, think of this as a 500-year plunder. That's what it was. Primitive accumulation. That's what Marx talked about.
Hi, my name is Bernadette. What I'd like to do is go back to when you were giving your original presentation and pick up one of the threads. You said that the American Indians actually had a democratic, were democratically organized and so on. I came across an idea that coincides with that in the book. I don't remember the title of it. I don't remember the author, but I do remember that the author's first book was The Zen of Motorcycle Maintenance. Whatever book he wrote after that, pardon? Okay, whatever Robert wrote after that, after The Zen of Motorcycle Maintenance. And what he presents in that is that in Europe, they had all these salons with all the rich people entertaining themselves, pretty much like the wealthy universities now. Harvard University will have people come speak who won a gold medal in the Olympics, or because places like the Ivy League universities can support having speakers who are of interest. So you could even look at this group now as a salon meeting. At any rate, what the author presented was that these explorers would go into America, and then they would be, when they went back to Europe, they would be invited back to these salons. Mm. And they would be expressing and telling how the Indians thought, because don't forget, we never really learned how they thought. And how they thought happened to be, guess what? the basis for the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and fraternity, and then the basis for the American Constitution and so on. And to me, that was such a mind-blowing idea. And I thought, oh, isn't that cool? The people who are originally here were really the people who are responsible for our present structure of government. And that's all I want to say, except I would appreciate you giving me the spelling of that author's name again. What did you say? The one who wrote The Art of... How do you spell his last name?
P-I-R-S-I-G.
And just a quick note that essentially I was discussing the Iroquois Confederacy because given the location of the 13 colonies in the Eastern Seaboard, that it's the an interaction with the Iroquois Confederacy and others that in terms of the research I've been able to do, it's out of that there was an impact, rather than because there was very little contact, of course, with the Indian nations of the plains and the West, but especially the Cayuga, the Onondaga, and this mostly in upstate, what is now upstate New York, from the far reaches almost the Lake Erie across to near the Hudson River. And Benjamin Franklin writes about this. These ideas, I didn't know about the, so these guys would go back to Europe and sort of be celebrated. And I mean, I know they were celebrated in a way, but sort of sit around and tell other people what was going on. But nobody's going to invite us to Harvard, but hey,
I was confused by something you were saying when I walked in a little bit late. You said something about Columbus setting a precedent in world history for, it sounded like you were saying that his manner of conquest and was set a precedent in world history, and I don't understand because expansion by conquest has been going on for thousands
of
years.
But in terms of the connection between, scholars argue, in terms of the connection between Europe and the Americas to initiate the transatlantic slave trade, because you're right. Go back. We even see this when we saw it in the film version, or some of us may have read Howard Fast's Spartacus. This didn't start with, you think of the Romans, you think of the Greeks, you think of Alexander, you think of blanking on the Mongols, Attila the Hun, etc. Yeah, Columbus was, he sort of was following a rich tradition in history.
Yeah.
But in terms of the connection with Europe and the Americas, because very little, even though we have some evidence that the Vikings may have been here in Labrador and so on, but the essential slave trade and the real conquest of the Americas, scholars argue that's Columbus's fundamental role. He was one of the first. I mean, there may have been someone before. I mean, we learn about him. And we learned, of course, well, he was Italian. Well, there was no Italy, actually. He was from Genoa. I actually got into it with some Italians about that, but we'll wait on that.
I wanted to go back and ask a question about, I think when you were speaking, you were referring to the standard text, I think is the name you gave it, when you were talking about American, like our outrage, you know, that we're not outraged at the actions.
David Stannard.
Stannard.
Who wrote a book called American Holocaust. Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, do you buy into his theory that we are not as outraged because of the worthiness of the victims versus, I was thinking that maybe part of the reason that we're not so outraged is because if for us to be outraged, then makes us as a nation have to feel guilty. And I think that might have something to do with it also, whereas it's easy for us to be outraged at the Nazis because we don't have to feel guilty as much about that.
Yeah.
Where we're not outraged right now about the genocides going on around the world because we're not doing anything about it, so we have to feel guilty about that. So I think there's something there also. Maybe.
Yeah, now that's certainly that's what I meant about, you know, how do we deal with Columbus? He's sort of part of our family, and it's harder to deal with outrage in our own family. I mean, it's easy to point across the street and say, oh, look at that guy, oh, he's really abusive to his wife and so on, or look what happened in Germany, etc. So part of it, you're exactly right, is that how it affects us and our sense of guilt, but also Stannard's argument is that whites rank higher in the world than people of color, all right? Our conception that European Jews killed in World War II are white Europeans. And we don't think, for example, that, and part of it is the understandable, powerful work done to remind people, I mean, Elie Wiesel is one of them, to remind people what happened. I knew virtually nothing about what happened to the Roma gypsies until I started reading, because there are no really viable spokespeople of that stature in the United States. So Stannard's argument is that even within horror, we rank people. So it's the guilt and the closeness, and we rank people in terms of race, in terms of gender, and so that some people become more worthy victims than others. I mean, it's a tragic, I think he'd argue it's a tragic fact. Yeah.
I have a question. I'm completely ignorant of history, so hence the question. Whatever rationale Columbus used to come over here and do what he did, he had to get people to do it. And so the guys who came over and like did all the work of conquesting the United States, were they mostly indentured servants and had to come, or were they promised some, you know, incredible better life, and once they got here, oh, by the way, in order to do this, you're going to have to get out there and kill people and risk your lives, and it's not as, the streets are not paved with gold. What was the rationale given to the people doing all the work of conquesting the United States, getting them over here from Europe?
Well, as far as I understand, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the crews on these ships were men. They were working men. They were poor men. They were not the the hoi polloi who were in the salons. You know, listening to wonderful chamber music, etc., or whatever, Baroque, is that the Baroque period, the late 15th century? There was an expectation that they were going to get riches, the riches of the New World. Though, as far as I understand from the reading I've done, you know, the average guy in that ship, and some of them died, you know, as they went into the New World from disease. They didn't really profit that much. And from what we know about Columbus, he didn't personally do that great himself. But then as more and more ships and conquerors come from Europe, I mean, they come back with gold, slaves, and it's clear, you know, to go back to Zach's point, that they're coming back with something. I mean, human cargo, before that when people used to go to the East, spices, etc. But they're coming back with gold, they're coming back with silver. And by the way, one of the amazing historic coincidences of this is, and I believe it's the same week, but it certainly is the same month, Columbus, those three ships leave, I think it was Cadiz, Spain, in August 1492. At the same time, ships are leaving that harbor carrying Jews who've been expelled from Spain. Because many years ago, I was chair of the Human Rights Commission in Ithaca, New York. We worked with the American Indian Program on the quincentennial in Columbus. We did things in schools and had meetings, and some of us attended that conference I mentioned. And the rabbi then at Cornell University did a wonderful lecture for us in a community hall downtown Ithaca. about the connection of Columbus and Jews at the same time leaving Spain. Columbus to come to the New World, Jews being expelled, and some, by the way, in terms of a long, amazing historical journey, ending up in the Southwest United States many, you know, generations later. But some clearly profited. There's no doubt about that. I mean, especially the kings and the queens and the, you know. Well, I mean, some of them, they used to impress, that may have been later, they used to just grab people. But I think part of it is the conditions facing folks at that time, again, males, facing difficult circumstances. Naomi may have the answer to this.
I also would like to point out that what they did then is just how they promoted it to us. I mean, our history tells it, that these people were heathens, they were primitives, and so forth. Well, this is what we do today to the young students in high school. We tell them all kinds of terrible things about what's happening over Iraq. They tell them all kinds of lies and things like that. But the one thing I wanted to say is that, first of all, I really think that Americans in particular are kind of idealists, and they like to idealize and see themselves as some sort of conquering, some sort of hero in some way. And it seems to me, you hear all the time about, well, we're going to bring democracy to Iraq or something like that. We don't even have democracy here, and we haven't had democracy here in years. Did we ever have democracy here?
Well, because that's other issue. We'll get to that.
I mean, if you have seen the film...
When did we get it?
Okay. U.S. What I've learned about U.S. foreign policy, and you see how we went in through all these countries from back in Iran in 1953. I mean, where's the democracy here? All the politicians are paid by the corporations, wow. So...
But we're not, this. We don't want to make this a, you'll see from Zinn's book, I mean, this is not a U.S. bashing book, because there's also a lot of resistance and wonderful things happening, is that, quote unquote, Americans are not unique. If you read the history, for example, I mean, I talked a little bit about, it's the 30th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. If you read about the French in Vietnam, and if you read about the English, the Brits going to China, and you read all sorts of, it happened to be Europeans, the Italians going to Ethiopia and going to Libya, that is the same notion that they are bringing to these, huddled masses, civilization, music, Vivaldi, whatever, but it's that whole, that's gone on. I mean, we think about, and the Dutch in what, is now Indonesia, and so all of the major European powers have done this. They're bringing, the French, we're going to bring you the, we're the seat of revolution, and, Rousseau and Voltaire, and we're going to bring all this stuff to you. And of course, they try to hook, I don't know how many tens of thousands of Vietnamese on drugs. The Brits in China. I mean, we all learned about Queen Victoria, right? The Victorian age. She was the biggest dope dealer of the 19th century. I mean, just read about the opium wars in China. The Brits went in and fought two wars to make sure that they were going to keep those people, hooked on dope. So U.S. is not unique in this regard. And we're actually kind of late in this, even though we have one long regime. But it's again, what are they going for? Zach said, what do they really want? Think about it. Here in the U.S., land, land and riches. And then we were talking during the break, some of you are familiar with Buffy St. Marie's wonderful song, "My Country 'Tis of Thee, Our People Are Dying." about, you know, you exploit us and you kill us and you take our land, then you develop the story. We learned the story. We read the textbooks. We saw the movies. I mean, I'm older than most people here, and, you know, the John Wayne movies and freeing the West and keeping white women safe and the last of the Mohegans with Henry Fonda as an Indian. I mean, you know, I didn't see the more recent one with Daniel Day-Lewis, but that's the story we learned. And if you're not helped to have some critical tools, a filter, so I can understand, I just take it in. And then that's why my students, when they used to read Zinn's book, wow, were they pissed off at me. Man, I used to tell them, you know, I'm just a bearer of bad news. I said, the Greeks used to actually kill the bearers of bad news, but I hope that they wouldn't do that to me. But because they didn't know this stuff. And then when they knew it, they were angry. Okay, and why didn't we learn this? And it's not about our neurons. I mean, this is not rocket science here. I mean, we know this stuff. It's easy. You know, it's not a complicated thing, really. So we, quote, the U.S. doing, and right, we're always going everywhere doing good in the world. I mean, how else? What are you going to do? Get up and say, we're going here because we're going to screw these people over. We're going there because they're terrible. We're going to stomp on them. I mean, because then people would say, wait a minute, well, why are we doing this? So we have to always do it for the good of the people that we're messing over. You know, that's, remember your mother, did your mother ever give you a castor oil or something? Say, it's good for you, you know, drink this stuff. Well, maybe not.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to ask a little bit, because I don't have a lot of knowledge, but as I understood it in the Central American countries that also got conquered after Columbus, you know, came and visited everywhere, that there were a lot of cultures there that weren't necessarily like the Native American cultures further north, that were more warlike, that engaged in human sacrifice, wore pelts of human flesh, and took slaves themselves from warring tribes. And you did touch on that they had their own conflicts and wars, but and it's depicted in their art. You know, you see lots of, you know, old pieces of art that have been discovered in digs that they were, some were a very violent people and brutal and cannibalistic. And so you can see the jump or the reason that the lurid things always get told over and over again. You know, I mean, look at the 6 o'clock news. It's always bad, right? How that barbaric kind of face could be easily put on the indigenous people here, and how that would reinforce the beliefs of the people committing the atrocities coming over from Europe, that it is for their own good. It is to save their souls from their pagan religion. The fundamental belief that you're not just of this earth, you're gonna go on to heaven or hell or whatever it is, was maybe something that made it worth the life of their current slave, you know, in their own mind. I mean, as far as a rationalization goes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, and so I just thought I'd bring it up because it is hard to see how any human being could come and commit such atrocities to such a peaceful people. So there must have been a little something there, you know, within everything that they were observing to help the rationalization. I'm just saying that, we're pretty equal across the board. There have always been wars in every culture, and we're observing one culture's kind of supremacist view. And like we touched on earlier with the Roman Empire and the Crusades, that this is stuff that's been going on for a long, long time. And, maybe it's part of human nature or not. Maybe it's something that human nature can breed out of itself. I would hope so for the future, you know. Anyway, just wanted to make that comment.
That's a very, excellent point. So we can't romanticize what was going on in various cultures, that everybody was sweet and wonderful, and there was extraordinary things in terms of the Aztecs and Mexico, what is now Mexico and Central America. No, thank you for sharing that.
Hi. A couple of things, disparate things. But one thing, little incident that came to mind when we're talking about the first contact of Europeans with Americans, you know, people of the continents. In the Norse sagas, or the Greenlander sagas, it actually tells, I mean, it's quite interesting to read this stuff and then say, wow, this was, as far as we know, the very first contact between essentially European and an American, someone from the continents. And you know, the guys identified, you know, Torben Karlsevne is like 1000, you know, AD in Newfoundland. And, you know, they write how the very first contact, so wow. And they were there not for gold, apparently. They were there because, you know, it's crowded in Greenland and greener pastures, you know, literally. But the first contact was him walking along a beach in Newfoundland and seeing a canoe, right? I mean, they had signs, distant signs, that there were native inhabitants there. They called them skraelings, that word, Scandinavian word, skraelings, whatever that meant. And underneath the canoe were like several, I think they were like, it was a big canoe, I think there were six natives sleeping, you know, skraeling, sleeping on the beach under this canoe, daytime. And what Torfson Karlsenes does is turns the canoe over and he kills them. And it's like, reading this thing, it was like, wait a minute, this is the first, this is the very first contact, wow. We know of between a European and an American, you know, and a Native American. It's like, you know, and they, you know, at that point, Christianity was just beginning to reach and hold on to Scandinavian, but very unlikely it had much of a hold on these guys. You know, but so, you know, that is a motive. And gold wasn't so much, you know, avarice maybe wasn't, but that was the response.
Wow.
You know?
No, this first time I've ever. Incredible. I mean, not to make light of it, but you could almost hear George Carlin telling that story. If they come across the canoe and you lift the canoe up and the guys say, hey, aren't you guys working? Aren't you going to do anything? Right, and then they get together and hang out. Because in human nature, to go back to the notion of human nature is as humans have done, which means in the contact, because Columbus tells us, the Taino, we're willing to give them everything. I mean, they were happy. They would give them everything. They didn't even know about swords. They cut themselves. They didn't want anything. They were generous. So in the struggle of humans, we've had the most absolutely horrific thing. I mean, who could even imagine some of the things that have been done? And then people coming together and, oh, you know, and they know they look different, and these guys have canoes, and some people didn't have clothes, and though in Newfoundland they would have had clothes, it's always chilly up in Newfoundland. And but it's amazing, the possibilities. But wow, that's a chilling, oh my God.
And just another quick, I know it's a disparate thought, was, you know, when you were talking earlier about what we're talking about here, is like we ourselves, you know, we are having to do our own truth commission. You know, like America is having to do its own truth commission. And we think of Burundi, Rwanda, you know, truth commission, South Africa truth. We're having to do our own truth commission, and we as a culture have never been willing to do our own truth commission. Maybe that's the fundamental point, because it's maybe not like we're so much worse or better than other countries that have done these things, but that's our maybe that's every nation's or culture's task, perhaps, if we're going to change the way things are going, is for us to do our own truth commission.
I've never heard it actually, Curtis, put that way, but it's very profound and moving. Because, for example, having worked with Vietnam veterans who then went back to Vietnam and met people in the villages where they were, where they actually fought, and saying that you need to somehow confront things and admit things as a way of healing. And that you're right, we've never had, there have been a few things. There was the $20,000 given to the descendants of those and remaining survivors of those who were interned in the camps during World War II, Japanese Americans. In fact, they have actually, there will be a ceremony April 30th, this Saturday, at Manzanar near Lone Pine. But we really haven't done that for what happened in this history vis-a-vis slavery and American Indians. And to open that up, on one hand, would be very controversial. On the other hand, how else do you begin to heal the past and move on?
If we ever decide to start a truth commission, I would suggest that start working from today, going backward, rather than going from 500 years ago and coming forward. I think we have a lot to investigate, especially with what's going on in Iraq and so many hundreds of thousands, I don't know how many civilians death and so forth. John, I was just going to ask you a question about, is there such a thing as progress in history? We read things about 500 years ago, and we see the same things almost happening today, more efficiently, more better technologies, but the attitudes and ideas are almost the same. I mean, the fact that we say we don't count Iraqi civilians is because they are less than us, and so they don't matter. And this is exactly what we see in these history books and so forth. So, is there a progress in history?
Well, maybe some people want to respond to that question. I'd be happy to do it, but let's stay on that. I mean, any thoughts that some of you have about Taraj's question?
No, we're not progressing. The people, it doesn't matter if it's Christopher Columbus who told Rodrigo, no, I saw land the night before, so you don't get the reward. And it doesn't matter now if it's the John Welch's of General Electric. They're all the same. The American people have been marginalized, we're slapped in the face constantly. And the truth of the matter is we're not progressing. You and I that sit here tonight are progressing. But go out tonight and talk to two or three people at any coffee bar, and they're going to look at you and go, gee, aren't you worried about the Dodgers? They're not going to sit down and talk about the fact that the young American soldiers have wiped out 100,000, have raped, have killed, have brutalized, have stuck metal pipes up people's rear ends. They're not going to talk about that, but they are going to talk this morning on headline news about a corporal that did some kind of wonderful heroic thing that saved some other men in his battalion. That is where we're at. Multi-corporations are controlling everything. It's not Christopher Columbus now, it's General Electric, it's Raytheon, it's Northrop, it's Boeing. Are we going to make progress? No.
Well, but at the same time, Zinn's argument about the cost of human progress. There has been progress in human history the last 500 years in a number of areas. But at the same time, he's really asking us, I mean, we've had immense technological progress, but at what price, what human price, which the people who were enslaved on those islands and in this, what is now the United States, we're not ever asked freely to make that choice. You know, would you like to be sort of a victim in this amazing human progress because you're going to work the land to create the wealth, which is going to build the cities, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a two-sided coin. Those things that some of us may take for granted that have opened up possibilities in the world, not just technologically, the human tragedy and cost of that progress is staggering. And of course, when I used to have discussions with my students, they'd say, well, you know, a lot of people did things like that then in the 15th century. And I'd have to walk through with them the 20th century. You're right. We know a lot more. we have a lot more knowledge about the world, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the 20th century was the most awesome, bloodiest, extraordinarily violent. I mean, it's incredible. And we have the means of doing things that Columbus and his men couldn't even imagine. So in some ways, we haven't, you know, we haven't gone anywhere. Naomi, you had your hand up before.
Well, I'd just like to make a comment here. I think that I'll throw out an idea here in terms of progress and in terms of what this gentleman said about, which I think many people believe that all cultures have had these difficult times in terms of brutalizing other people. And I think that there's this general acceptance among people that that we're dealing with human nature here, that all nations have embarked upon these kinds of massacres and expeditions, etc. I've heard this before, and I've said this a number of times to people, and I've never heard it contradicted. I may be wrong in this, but I believe that India, 6,000 years of recorded history, is a nation that's never conquered another nation. They certainly, according to various standards of human behavior, certainly it could be argued that they treat their own people badly in some ways. But they don't go, they haven't ever, apparently, they haven't ever conquered, gone to war against a neighbor, occupied that neighbor, tried to expand themselves. And that's, we'll go back 6,000 years. So I ask myself, is there something about the Hindu religion, or is it something about their culture that makes them so different from all the other major nations of the world? And
what about Kashmir?
Pakistan.
I mean, there's some serious fighting going on.
I cannot comment.
But you meant as a nation, right? You're talking about specifically nations. Because again, we have Columbus's, you know, unless he was lying, which I doubt. That in terms of what we know about the Taino and some of the groups that he met in the Caribbean and others whom we know from some of the studies of the South Pacific, that clearly, I mean, we're not, these are not nations, but that, in fact, Kirkpatrick Sale, when he wrote the book about the quincentennial, I think he called it The End of Paradise or The Fall of Paradise, that that here was a people as pacific and gentle with each other, though there were other tribes in the Caribbean that were far more, you know, the Columbuses, you know, they went after, not first, by the way.
Spain went against
other nations.
Oh, yeah.
And you're, you know,
yeah. It's, I mean
yeah. far away, other nations. They sent ships, the Spanish Armada, to conquer other nations.
Right.
And all I'm saying here is that on its borders, yes, but or parts of its what has been considered part of India. But all I'm saying is that that nation never went on an attack like conquering large areas of land away from its borders and conquering them like China has done.
I don't know. I don't know the history of how it became India, because the whole, you know, if you think of the whole history of nation states, you know, how did they get created? So, Naomi, you've been trying to jump in here.
To respond to this person,
sure.
When we attack people, we might rationalize what we've done, whether they're benign or aggressive, but it's never justified. We can find all kinds of rationalizations, but there's no way to really justify. We know, you know, with if we're living consciously, that we can't justify. But I was just thinking about the Spain in 1492. My grandfather, one of my grandfathers, was traced back to the Inquisition. I'm Jewish. And I was thinking, you know, that culture was flourishing. It was like a renaissance going on. And then we descended into this pit of kind of savagery. You know, we went from this flowering of the arts and the intellect in Spain, and then
it's interesting to put what happened on these excursions into context with the demise of that kind of a culture. You know, I think, I was just thinking that Zinn maybe, I know he's talking about this country, but I think it would be interesting to put what happened here in perspective, to join it with what had just occurred and the demolishing of this great flowering of the intellect and the arts, and it was as if it was being rubbed out, you know?
You mean in Southern Europe and France with the Moorish and influence?
Uh-huh.
And well, a number of scholars have argued that as countries, people move into empire and conquest of others, that inevitably leads to their own internal decline.
But Spain
or later.
Had already declined in 1492 when those ships set sail.
Right, I mean, Queen Isabella and
the Moors,
Ferdinand.
The Muslims and the Jews and the Christians had this incredible melange, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, to see or to maybe to study the demise of that kind of a culture and then what proceeded out of it. You know, like it was the death throes, and now you have this birth pangs of something trying to happen. Because, you know, what Taraj says, it might give us a picture of what's happening really in the long term, historically, over historical time.
Of course, we could follow Taraj's idea and start from the present and go backward. I have his historian friend of mine, that's how he teaches students history. He actually starts with objects. So if he wants to teach students about the whole history of the food industry, I mean, he actually did a lesson with a hamburger and where it comes from and the labor and traces it back and then the history of the country and et cetera. That is, you start with concrete present and you move back because, I mean, I remember being in school, we started way back somewhere and let's say American history, and my students used to tell me they never even got to the Vietnam War, so the Vietnam to them was like the 12th century. Maybe they got to World War II. So maybe you're right, we start from now and then you walk backward, start from the US and Iraq, Central America, etc., and you go back, and trace this not from there to here, but from here to there. That'd drive all the textbook publishers crazy, by the way. I mean, they'll just go nuts. We only have it's about 9:00, so let's start to close this so we can get out of here. And
okay, well, I wanted to respond to, there were a few comments about how could Columbus have recruited, or how could anybody, go on a journey to, to commit genocide? And my comment was that Columbus wasn't going to commit genocide.
Right.
He was going to India. Suppose that instead of having met these guileless Arawak people who were ready to give him anything, he had reached his destination and had the shrewd, experienced, seasoned Indian spice traders to contend with, and he'd simply gone, done his shopping, and come home.
Yeah, right. No, you're right. He didn't set out to do the first voyage, but when they came back, and made sure they took slaves, et cetera, et cetera. Then, because they knew what they had done the first voyage, but you're right. People start and right. He thought he was somewhere, and he wasn't. And the whole other thing. Remember, we learned Columbus proved the earth wasn't flat. People knew this long before Columbus. I mean, who invented that thing?
Washington Irving.
Well, he was the one who wrote that book about somebody being asleep for 20 years. Are you going to trust him? Yeah.
What if he, had just ended up in his original destination and had found these, spice traders in India? As Zinn points out, on a side note, he never would have made it there. He was lucky he found land because another 30 days, if the ocean wasn't as big as he thought it was, they would have all been dead at sea. So it was sort of.
Yeah. We're going to give this gentleman the final word tonight.
Wow.
Well, we have to.
I get scared.
Get the chairs back and everything. Yeah.
And then let me try to make a kind of a wrap up then. I think we should stay on the chapter Columbus, etc., but at the same time, your comment about the going backwards, it has a very important historical thing, which is most often we look at the history to understand ourselves today. It helps a lot. So from this point of view, it's very good to go backwards, but also when you look at all the history, you have to keep looking at what is the impact of this now? What does this teach for me, to my life, to my society? As far as the society goes, you are a professor, understand, me too. We know that the classes, they have personalities, which is not just the sum of the people. They behave differently. Anybody who taught a class for several classes for a few years, we know that. Now, the societies also, I believe, is the same. The American society happens to be, unfortunately, a particularly aggressive one. This probably has things to do with the Christianity, which is not a very good religion or a superstition, but it is a very aggressive. I came from Brazil, so I can compare societies since I have lived 28 years there and 30 years here. So now, but then what can we do? If people are in this society, we have to think, okay, what can we do with this? We cannot justify and say because the others are aggressive too, like you said, because as the lady there said, it does not justify that other people have done similar things. For one thing, as far as I know, no society have done as bad as the United States have done. So it did not justify to begin with. But then have to see, what moral can we take out of this? My opinion then, because I have to close now then, is that one thing that comes from the Romans, power is very dangerous. At one time, I became a director of the electronics program where I used to teach, and I was very scared because I got power. And I know that power corrupts, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous for the other and for me, because then I can destroy myself for losing my humanity and think that I'm a good guy, blah, 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 which I'm not. Nobody is. We always do what we can, given to our past and so on. So on top of the United States being powerful and have a history of aggression and so on, there is the other danger that it happened to have become very powerful. And then it creates, this is a very particularly dangerous and bad brew. And then what came out, I think, is awful, no? When I look back at the history, I don't see a society that have done as much damage.
Yeah.
Not only for people, but for the environment, and maybe destroying the holy thing and so on. But we have tried then to fix it as much as we can. Sometimes I get desperate because I feel sad, but then all we have to do is in every step that we do whatever we can to make it better. And maybe we don't fix it, but then at least when we die, you say, okay, I did all I could.
Well, your comment about power, and let's end on that, that without the ability to actually do these things, of course, the history would have been different. I mean, you might have this idea, we want to conquer all these people, we want to do this, we want to take all their gold, their land, but if you can't do that, different. Okay, thank you.
You have been listening to a discussion of Chapter 1 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, led by Dr. John Marciano. This is the second disc in this set. The first contained Dr. Marciano's commentaries on Chapter 1. Every month, this group meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. John Marciano at 310-393-4815 or email johnmarciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of the decentralized democratic civic media.